This is Vibrant Spaces, a show about placemaking, activating, and connecting city spaces for the communities you serve.
Hey there, friends, and welcome back to our Vibrant Spaces third episode in season two. I'm your host, Tim Souza, with my amazing co-host and boss lady, Emily Craven.
Hola. Emily.
And we are so excited today because we are entering into a first of two little mini series in this season. This one focused on downtown Vancouver's Business Improvement Association, or if you're in the state, that would be a Business Improvement District, a BID. And so we're so excited to speak to two Claires as a part of this two-part mini series. They are both Irish, and one gave us an Irish goodbye on the way out, and the other one said an Irish hello on the way in. So we're super excited to jump into these. First person we have today is Claire Warner. She's kind of the former director of planning and engagement for downtown Vans BIA. Emily, can you tell us a little bit about this Claire Warner person?
Yeah, so Claire Warner, the beautiful, the delightful Irish Claire Warner, she has been living in Canada since 2015. The past 6 years, she's been working with Downtown Van, which, as Tim said, Business Improvement Association, covers 90 blocks in downtown Vancouver. So it is the largest BIA in Western Canada. And as that placemaking manager, Claire's work really ranged from beautification projects, so like public art, to streetscape enhancement and laneway transformations, to leading urban activations and events like the Granville Block Party and the Summer Movie Night series. And so Claire believes that placemaking is about building, you know, civic pride and fostering human connection through environmental design. She's really passionate about creating spaces that are conducive to like memorable moments and spontaneity. And she really ushered them through COVID, right? When it was quite difficult to get people out and about and engaging safely. And I think that the thing that this first episode in Vancouver, because we, as Tim said, we do have two, the conversation really raises this big question of like, we hear it across North America that events are a main placemaking tool, and bringing up that question, can events alone build vibrancy, or do they really risk being like sugar highs with no long-term nutritional value, I suppose, the analogy.
I think the word that I know that they used out of Vancouver that came out of both of these conversations was the word lift. So like, how long is that lift? Is it a day? Is it a week? Is it a month? How long is that sugar high? Right? Kind of where you're getting at.
Yeah. Exactly. And, and we do like, we do hear kind of like the ranges, you know, there's the Taylor Swift's versus their Granville Block Party. So like, we'll dive into that in this episode. And I think that the thing that I love is that Claire shares things like behind the scenes, like infrastructure required to make these events happen and, you know, to make them inclusive and frequent and city shaping, so that people come to look forward to them year after year, which I think is a part of building that consistency of visitation, right?
Yeah, and that seasonality too, right? Especially in a city like Vancouver that experiences seasonality a little differently than the rest of Canada. It's really exciting to be over the border in this city this time to have that kind of conversation, and just split it into two episodes. You know, so experience, like I'm excited to have the conversation as we split this into two episodes of exploring, you know, the limits of and the power of events, as you kind of just mentioned, and what happens when you do create that seasonality, but then also jumping into next week, how they go beyond that, right? And so focusing this first one on what does these event building pieces look like, and what is it like when you're kind of forced to, because of COVID, because of global environmental things, build an event first, you know, expectation for 90 city blocks, that's residents, that's business owners, that's third spaces, all that exist within that downtown Vancouver space, without, you know, calling it something like revitalization. And that's part of one of my favorite pieces of what Claire talks to us about, is how the language has changed from revitalization. You'll have to stay tuned to figure out what that is that they use instead. But that mindset shift, I think, opens up a very different kind of strategy for the city as well.
Yeah, it's like inviting people in, right? It's trying to invite people in rather than making them feel that you're fixing something that's wrong. I think that, you know, personal curiosity, we were especially interested in how they were using events to draw people back into downtown. And, you know, what happens when that festival is over? What is left behind? Who is staying? So let's get into it.
And what do the people remember? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So without further ado, Claire Warner, everyone.
Hello. Thank you so much for joining us, Claire.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
We're very excited to be able to hit our, I think it's our first Canadian city, even though I'm based in Canada. How is this our first Canadian city, Tim? I don't know.
I think it's just how we have been focused as a team recently, mainly on the States and a little bit on Canada. Maybe that's what the whole world is focused on at the moment. Mainly on the States, a little bit on Canada. It's okay. We're just on theme. We're on theme. Well, Claire, it has been awesome to kind of get to know you a little bit over the last couple calls, but I want to help our audience get to know you a little bit as well. So you've been in Vancouver since 2015, correct?
Yeah, so I moved here back in 2015 from Ireland. I'm originally from South Kilkenny, a place called Mooncoin in Ireland. And emigrating is something that we just love to do in Ireland. So we definitely have a sense of adventure. And at the time, Canada was kind of in my sights. And I really had no idea what to expect when I first moved here. But Vancouver seemed like a really good idea. And I've been here ever since. And absolutely love it. It's a great city to live in.
That's beautiful. I Vancouver was also where I landed, and I didn't understand how the phone numbers worked in Vancouver. And so when I landed, I got myself a phone number, not realizing that the cell phone numbers were very location specific. And then I moved out of Vancouver and everyone was like, "Where is your phone number from?"
People get really hung up on that here. Like 604 is the original area code here, and if you have like the new 236, like that's
exactly
what are you even doing. So speaking of Vancouver, then, I mean, why Vancouver out of all of the cities in Canada, first off?
So I actually had some friends who had moved here years ago, and I actually studied in oil or in geology. So I was considering working in oil and gas. So I got my visa to come and live in Canada. And initially my intention was to go to Calgary. And I guess with time, I just realized that would not be the industry for me. It wouldn't align with my values. And I ended up at a family reunion with a long lost cousin from Seattle who founded the store Zoomies. And he was telling me all about Vancouver and how beautiful it was. And I touched base with my friends who had also been here. And I remember there was this one guy called Jeff, and he was telling me that, you know, Vancouver is one of the only places where you can sit with your feet in the sand, the sun at your back, and the skyline in front of you and the mountains behind it. And I just remember that sounding so beautiful. So I was like, okay, I'll give Vancouver a try and we'll see what happens. And after I got here, I just landed on my feet really quickly. It was very easy to kind of integrate into the community. And I had intended on going on to New Zealand afterwards for a while, but I just could not leave. Vancouver has a way of doing that.
It stole your heart.
It sure
so,
did.
Okay, so yeah. So then as a place that has stolen your heart, what would be like the most special locational place in Vancouver for you?
Oh, I love the seaside. The seawall is probably a pretty typical answer, but I've just got such great memories of like first bringing my family there, and it's such an iconic spot for Vancouver. So it extends all around the downtown peninsula into Kitsilano. You can see the North Shore Mountains, and really anywhere that you can kind of go in and take a swim as well. There's a great spot called Wreck Beach as well. That is my favorite beach to swim at. I mean, it's just beautiful. It's really like the epitome of Vancouver.
And so, you know, it's really awesome that you both have gotten to find this new city and call it your own and then make it your own over the last decade. But you also get to help work in building its thriving placemaking ecosystem. Yeah. And so I'd love to maybe transition our conversation into that a little bit. And I'm super excited to really hear about how this place-led ecosystem functions within the city of Vancouver. And so to start off, can you quickly describe that, what that landscape looks like and how your VA that you get to work for that empowers this fun community fits into this place-led ecosystem that we hear is a pride point from the city of Vancouver?
Yeah, 100%. It's a very interesting ecosystem in Vancouver. And I think from my perspective, Downtown Van is definitely at the helm of that. And we're doing some really great work alongside all of the partners that it takes to get that work done. And so placemaking to me is really about building civic pride and fostering that connection to place among the community, and how that kind of factors in for us as an organization, and we're a business improvement association, is that it has this kind of positive impact that goes far beyond just the projects and has this kind of real longevity and legacy to it. And so we focus our programming and I guess our take on placemaking from the BIA's point of view is focused in two different streams, and those are activations and beautification. So activations being different large scale events, or even, you know, kind of medium to small scale events or pop-ups that kind of instill connection, are moments where people can take in a performance, go see a, you know, a huge street festival, or take in an outdoor movie on a plaza. And beautification is more to do with the physical surroundings and streetscape enhancements. So when we look at beautification, we're thinking public art, laneway transformations. The Pink Alley is a destination that we created alongside HCMA and the City of Vancouver. And even things like street banners and murals and sculptures. Downtown Van is very much, I think, leading the way with the partners that it takes to bridge that kind of public and private gap and bring a little bit of vibrancy to Downtown Vancouver.
Yeah, so that's I think, is one of my interesting areas that I always like to double click on in these in these podcasts, which is, you mentioned that this ecosystem is relying upon this network of public and private partnerships. How does that look like for you? Like, what is the net positive, you know, exchange that is involved in these public and private partnerships?
Yeah, I think we're so well positioned to build on that, because we are a BIA, because we're a Business Improvement Association. The net positive impact is always going to come back to thriving social and economic impact. And so where we fit in is that we obviously advocate for and do our work for the member businesses, but we work really closely with the city to do that. We work really closely with property managers, and we also don't own any space downtown. Like, first of all, we're on unceded territories. And so what we do is partner with the different property managers and owners of within the 90 blocks in our district, and say, okay, what kind of space is there access to? Who holds like the responsibility for these spaces? Is it the city? Is it the province? Is it a private entity? And we've worked with them over the past 10, 15 years to kind of build this understanding that access to public space is a responsibility. And so POPs, or publicly accessible but privately owned spaces, have been our focus, as well as city owned kind of plazas and park spaces. So then it's kind of about coming up with a strategy to activate them or improve or enhance the experience of being in those spaces through beautification efforts.
Beautiful. And so I'm curious as to whether you could give us some examples of some of those public and private partnerships, maybe an example in terms of the property management as one, and maybe an example between the city as another, to give us kind of an idea of the breadth of those in the real world.
Yeah, 100%. So one that I really like to give a shout out to is Hudson Pacific Properties. They have a complex downtown of several different towers, and they've redone their entire space, not only in a physical sense. They worked with, I think it was HAPA Collaborative, to redesign the space into the Dunsmore Patio, it's now called. But they've also then coupled that with activations. And what I think is really smart about how they've done that is that they've put someone in charge of doing that internally. So not all property owners or property managers actually have those resources with someone at the helm to dictate programming. And when I say programming, I'm talking, okay, it's Cherry Blossom Festival. How do we connect with the Cherry Blossom Festival to do something in our space for that time of year? And then also, like, what kind of programs can we do in our vacancies? And also, what if we did some busking? And what if we just put out some public seating? What if we did a mural here? So they have someone at the helm to literally manage that space. And her name is Ashley Chandler. And Chuck Wee, who's on our board at Downtown Van. So that's the team at Hudson Pacific that I think have really been transformative in that space. And a lot of the other property managers in Downtown Vancouver are really looking to them and seeing, okay, how can we kind of replicate that? I think that's a really fun thing about property managers, is that they get a little bit competitive. So we love
to see being a little bit mercenary in my look of that is what do the property managers get out of that? Like, is it that they no longer have vacancy in their street level, like, areas? Like, why do you think that Hudson Pacific Properties have really doubled down on that?
Ultimately, they want to see a return to the office, and they want to see a decline in the vacancy rate, right? So the more demand that there is on the space, the better the outcome is going to be for them. And it also sets them up in a much more positive light, you know, as a stakeholder in the city. And so we can kind of then come in and be that support to them when they're looking to, let's say, get a different permit, or they don't necessarily know how to go about the right route to get there. So it has all these positive knock-on effects for them in terms of their bottom line as well.
So in terms of partnerships, then you are helping do regulatory pathways for them. You are maybe potentially partnering with them on program ideas. Do you guys also share funds for programming as well?
Yeah, we can do. And a lot of the time it's like, okay, there's a certain festival that is looking for a space. Okay, we'll make the introduction, or we'll go to them with ideas. But because they have someone at the helm, they have someone kind of really managing and in charge of those ideas already. So I think the partnership is a very symbiotic one.
So if we were to look at a city that maybe didn't have someone at the helm, as you're saying, who's as active in from a property management side in advocating for themselves in that same way, what would you recommend to someone who might be in your position in a different city who doesn't have that partner reaching across the table the other way?
Yeah, and I think they're definitely at the top tier. Where it often ends up is sort of in that middle ground of someone maybe is doing the work off the side of their desk. But in my role and in our role at Downtown Van, it's still about kind of making those introductions and understanding the assets that you have in a space. So our space being 90 blocks, like in downtown Vancouver, we have to understand what the different maybe opportunities are with certain sites, where there might be a plaza that would work really great for sculpture. And we know that the Biennale has sculptures that are in storage that, okay, maybe we can make these introductions. So I think it takes time, first of all, to understand like the network of the ecosystem, who exists in what space, and then kind of how to connect the dots. But putting in that effort of understanding who the sort of cultural organizers are out there, and then who holds the access to what those cultural organizers are trying to access, whether that is funding or space or support in permitting. I think that's where we can really come in as that connector, because we work really closely with the municipality. We have this goal of an enhanced and vibrant downtown Vancouver, and we understand the sort of maybe policy or kind of other strategies that can support each other, and then bridging the gaps and the connections to get there.
Okay, so I mean, you guys are actively involved then in the downtown arts space, touching all of these different parts of the ecosystem. And I'm assuming that's why the downtown public arts strategy lies with your team versus the city, and which is another thing that makes Vancouver so very unique as an ecosystem, because you're a BIA that is running the downtown public arts strategy. So can you talk to me a little bit about that, and then what the next 3 to 5 years look like as you guys are overseeing the strategy for the city of Vancouver?
Yeah, 100%. It probably is a bit more unusual for a BIA to, you know, execute on their own public art strategy. And of course, it still relies on partnership from members, from the city of Vancouver, and from artists themselves. But really, we've been doing this work all along, and the public art strategy is really just a way for us to formalize that process. And it's got 4 strategic priorities. So the first one is to include members and local communities in the art process. So over the next 3 to 5 years, that will look like forming more of a committee to inform on the public art process. It's even looked like considering and forming in a public art roster, or an artist roster that we created last year, where folks can apply to be part of this roster and we can go to them for specific projects. So a little bit more transparency in the work that we're doing. The second strategic priority is creating opportunities for artwork that enhance the perception of safety. So considering creative lighting as an artwork, and including artworks of various scales, permanence, and budgets is the third priority. I think for us, the way that people experience art can be really broad, especially in the public setting. So we consider that to be even art workshops, experiential art, not just murals and not just sculptures, but it's a very, very broad spanning kind of term that has various kind of scales of permanence to different pop-ups as well. And then the last priority is to instigate impact through impact and action through public art. So we really want to see engagement, and we want to see people really immersing themselves in public art downtown. And I think the reason that it's us that's doing it is because of the position that we hold as a BIA, being really connected to members, to the impact of the work that we're doing in placemaking, but also having that very close relationship with the city and with landowners in downtown Vancouver.
You know, that's interesting. I think I wanted to throw to M, you were talking about there's a value between like those temporary pop-up experiences and those that are a little bit more permanent. And I think that what Claire was just talking about sounds like an amazing backdrop, you know, for that conversation. I want to toss it to you to chat a bit about that and ask Claire about what Vancouver's doing with that.
Yeah, because and I think that variance in permanence is really valid. I have heard, you know, people kind of look at that and say, oh, you're just throwing money at art that doesn't even stay there forever. Like, what are you doing? But I think that it's an acknowledgement that not only tastes change, but politics changes, right? And when you look at the permanence of a structure and you say, oh, this is, you know, $250,000 sculpture that's got to live here forever, and then 10 years down the track, people are like, why is this giant sculpture of balls here? We don't understand. And so the money that's invested in that makes it harder to change with the culture and the immigration that happens and the new politics and all of those sorts of things. And so yeah. I think that's very smart, that's semi-permanence of acknowledging that, yes, we do want to have some cornerstone pieces that maybe don't offend anyone, but at the same time, we also acknowledge the fact that semi-permanence is a thing, but also newness is a thing. Like with the attention economy being so short, the fact that if you have something where people know that every year this artwork in this particular plaza is going to be replaced, or every quarter or whatever, it encourages people to come back and with a frequency that can be very strategic.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, you know, a great example of this would be COVID. Like, we had so many different pop-ups that were in response to the COVID initiatives. And like, where would we have been, or where would we be now if they had to be permanent, or if that hoarding that, you know, covered up a business was still there? So I think art is really responsive to its environment and to the circumstances of the moment. And it also, like, the way that we're viewing the different kind of scales of permanence also allows for this not to just be for tourists. Like, we don't just want the digital orca downtown, because, I mean, I live here. How often am I going to visit that? I'm going to be more likely to go to something that's new or exciting or interesting than, you know, back to the digital orca that I first visited in my first week here. So it allows us to really cater to both locals and tourists as well.
Yeah, really leveraging how people utilize that, the physical built environment, that space, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the and placing. And I think that, you know, it's fascinating as we've had this conversation around what placemaking looks like in the city of Vancouver. You mentioned that though there are things like this that your team leans into to build and empower and enhance, there are things that you try to stay away from, specifically like vernacular choice, words like revitalization, which has like a negative connotation for your team as you're doing all of this really important work. And so I was curious if you could potentially tell us why we don't like the word revitalization so much in Vancouver, and what words you would prefer us utilize instead that gives the same meaning without the negative connotations, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting conversation. I think for me, the word revitalization can sometimes be overused when we're talking about planning, or in particular specific areas. And the negative connotation, I think, can also be attributed towards gentrification. So what is the opposite of revitalization? Is it going to be gentrification? Is it not? Is it just bringing back vitality? Maybe the vitality is already there and we just need to expose it or enhance it. So it's a word that comes up a lot in like the partnership between economic development and placemaking, and just one of those things that comes up a lot and you're like, oh, there's that word again. And I think for me, it's really enhancing sense of place. It's not about, you know, coming up with a brand new project and putting a square peg in a round hole. It's about expanding on the essence of a place and establishing the identity that's really linked to place. So revitalizing and revitalization can sometimes be a bit of a trigger word, because it's very tied to economic development. And yet I think my preference would be to look at how do we enhance this space and how do we support it.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Cool.
And, but it's also when you're looking at things, as you say, from a negative or positive lens. Right, where like, yeah, what is the wolf you feed? Is it the negative one or the positive one? And you're right, revitalization does imply that something is wrong. And while that might be the case, I think that it's various forms of adjustment where this thing is going right and this thing needs adjustment, and being able to balance those.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that the word vitality, you know, I hadn't really thought about the etymology of revitalization when you were like, well, that, you know, the space has vitality. You're like, oh, I think it really does frame it from that perspective of like, you're right, it's the wolf you're feeding. Are we coming in saying this is a neighborhood that is not vital, you know, doesn't have enough of vitality all on its own?
I think that one way that that downtown Van has done this really well is that you have a flagship event which you call the Granville Block Party. And so can you tell us a little bit about what this activation is, how long it goes for, and why you throw it? Because that definitely seems to be that premium example of building on the vibrancy and vitality of what is already there.
Yeah, I'm so proud of the Granville Block Party. This is our signature event, especially for Granville Street. It takes place on within the Granville Entertainment District, which is our hub for nightlife, but it takes place in the daytime, which is what we really wanted to highlight. And speaking of partnerships, this is probably one of the best examples of that. So initially it began as a COVID program, open up the streets, and it was for 6 weeks, and we called it the Granville Promenade for the first 2 years. So we ran it for 6 weekends in August for the first 2 years, and we ran it a little bit further south on Granville Street, and we started to see that the, I guess, need for what the event was wanting to become was evolving over time. And so what initially came down from a councillor mandated motion to, you know, identify what we can do to close down the streets on these weekends turned into this absolute festival. And so I got to give a shout out to Councillor Sarah Kirby-Young for really beginning the idea for this program. And we've been at the helm of leading it now since its inception. So it takes place over 2 days at the end of August. And the goals are really to shine a spotlight on Granville Street and what is possible for Granville Street. It's a very important time in history for Granville Street right now, as the city is working on the Granville Street plan. So an event like this is the perfect opportunity to showcase it at its finest. The other goals include, you know, engaging attendees and communities to make that really notable economic impact and to foster diverse programming, which is everything that this event is about. So over those 2 days, we get about 40 to 45,000 people coming out. We've got drag, we've got voguing, we've got several different stages, we've got food trucks, we've got Indigenous programming, we've got kids zones, we've got busking, we've got all sorts of entertainment happening, and the place is bustling and alive. And I've never seen, like, the negative comments just don't exist during this time, which is probably the opposite to what people would usually expect of Granville Street. So I think for me, it's a really great way to highlight what's possible. And the partnerships that it takes to get there are multifaceted. So it's businesses, it's with our event organizers, Event Lab, it's with the city staff. They're super supportive in, they've been super supportive in getting to the place where we now have the entire 2.5 blocks fully licensed, and it's completely family friendly at the same time. So we've got that support from the city, from VPD, and ensuring it's a really safe event as well.
Interesting. And so you'd mentioned earlier that, you know, locals want to come back to events and things that change and that are different. And yeah, this is these 40 to 45,000 people that come, are they local, or do you find that they are people coming in from out of the area?
It is a little bit of both. There's a lot of tourists that come at that time of year because of the cruise ships. But we get a lot of locals, and we get a lot of like repeat customers coming back, or repeat attendees coming back every year, because it's such a unique experience. And what's really interesting is that we did some analysis of the Taylor Swift event impact. And that was a lot of out of towners coming in. And while the impact was obviously really, really high, when it compares to a more local event like the Granville Block Party that still locally has a high impact, the economic lift that is experienced is extended for the like of a local event, versus for Taylor Swift, it declined like the day after she left town. So I think what that shows us is that people come to Granville, see the experience that they can have, and they keep coming back for longer after. Which is exactly what we want to see happening. And the other thing is that we've got such positive response and feedback from attendees and from the businesses every year that they want to see it return every year. You know, it's got about 100 performers over the 2 days and the 4 stages. It's got a high economic impact of close to $1 million just over those 2 days. It's got 30 volunteers, so it's a really highly engaged event with a high economic and social impact.
Can you speak a little bit more to that halo effect of the local event versus the Taylor Swift kind of bump? how long have you seen that last for? Like, is there a certain percentage that it increases spending? Like, you've stated that, like, people believe and feel that they are safer in downtown, so it's slowly changing their perception of how safe someone is in a downtown street, particularly during the day. Can you speak a little bit more about that halo effect and how that manifests?
Yeah, 100%. So what we see when we survey people, we ask, how safe do you feel here? You know, why are you coming down, or why are you here? 50% of people are coming downtown just for the event, which means that we're bringing about 20,000 people downtown just to attend that. And of course, when there's higher attendees and when there's kind of positive social interaction, that sense of safety is going to raise and going to increase. There's more eyes on the street as well, so people feel really safe, and they report that to us during our surveying as well. And then on the economic side, we found that about 65% of people were more motivated to come downtown just because they've experienced this event, which is huge. That's more than half of the people coming and saying, you know what, I should come downtown more often. Like, this is actually really great. Like, this is what I can experience when I come here. And so we see just such a high, like, really positive outcome from this in both the social, the safety, and the economics. The data shows that the lift that's experienced from a more local event like Block Party is prolonged from a more high impact event like Taylor Swift.
Can I ask a question about that long tail? So you were saying that, like, in the day or so that the event is running $1 million transacts, what does that lift look like on an economic development impact, say, over, like, over what period of time are we talking the lift following versus like a Taylor Swift experience?
Let me see. I've got it. So for the Granville Block Party, the lift happened from the 24th of August to the 1st of September last year. Whereas Taylor Swift, she was here from the 6th, 7th, and 8th. And by the 10th, so 2 days after, there was no more economic lift from what our data shows. And you can read more on that in the State of Downtown report that we released about 2 weeks ago. So we do an annual economic report, and we just released that data.
I love a good report. We will add that to the show notes, everyone, just so you know. And maybe we can add the art strategy report into those show notes as well.
100%. It's coming out tomorrow. I'll send it over.
Amazing. Beautiful. I'm excited by that. So how would other cities look at being able to set this up? So is the idea, you said that the idea is to show off like what Granville Street can be and what it can do. So is the idea to have other people do block parties and also as a city that maybe has not done blocking off of the streets frequently, how would you go about setting this up as a new city?
Yeah, 100%. So over the 6 years, it's obviously taken time to get to this point where we feel it's at its peak. And of course, there's going to be growing pains. So what I'd recommend for a city who's starting out is we had the political buy-in. This was a councillor mandated motion to identify how to block off the street and open it up to foot traffic. And obviously we used COVID as that that kind of initial sort of catalyst to do that. So obviously identifying the opportune moments is good. Having the political support as well as the city staff who kind of know how to execute on and support you. That's been crucial. We found great partners who had done similar events in the past and who were able to kind of execute on the logistics of that for us as production partners. So really knowing who's out there that can execute on your vision and starting small. Like, it's never going to start out at a 40,000 capacity event, but it could grow to that depending on like the scale and obviously your budget. We've looked at grants, we look at sponsorship and different ways to support that as well beyond just so that we can kind of grow it to where it's gotten. So we've been successful in that right as well. And I'd say for us, we want to showcase Granville as that. We've also created a guidebook on how to plan an event like this and what resources are available to do that. So the goal being to kind of drive more different festivals and programmers towards Granville Street and identify that as an opportunity.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Claire. I appreciate that. Is that guidebook also something that we can share with the the audience there, or is this an internal guidebook?
I don't think it's finalized. Yeah, it's more an internal toolkit for like people in Vancouver that are festival organizers.
Fine. If you guys want to poke Claire for her internal book.
Yes.
Book her now. Right. Awesome. Well, Claire, thank you so very much for joining us today and for bringing all of these brilliant, like, different lenses to the city of Vancouver. I know it's a city that I, when I moved to Canada, I also started my experience in Vancouver before moving to Toronto. So I know it's a beautiful city to be in, to land in. It's so wonderful to know that they have someone like yourself sitting in the helm, keeping everything up and moving positively and keeping the health of the community going. With that being said, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on our call today. And the last question that Emily and I like to ask everyone is there a book or books that you like to give as a gift, and why? You give so many gifts to the city of Vancouver. Is there a book or books that have influenced your life that you love to give other people, or that you would want to give someone else because it set you off on such an amazing direction in your own journey?
I am an avid reader, but I'm a fiction reader. Some reason, cannot
sit
through like an educational book about placemaking. Like, I find them very useful, but I'm going to talk fiction here, and I'm going to go one kind of weird and one just beautiful. The weird book that I love is called The Mustache, and it's about a man who shaves his mustache one day, and then his girlfriend's like, "What? You never had a mustache." And it goes from there, and he basically goes, is he going crazy? Is he not? We'll see. It's a very, very well-written book that just kind of causes you to understand maybe like from someone else's perspective every once in a while. And the second book that I'd recommend is The Covenant of Water. It's just a beautifully, beautifully written book. It's a bit of a chunky book, but the character development in that, that was my favorite book of last year that I'm currently recommending to people. So,
love it. Beautiful. Well, thank you, Claire, so much for coming and joining us on the Vibrant Spaces podcast. It's been a pleasure. We look forward to chatting to other people in the Vancouver area as well, hopefully as part of this season. But otherwise, thank you kindly. We really appreciate you being here.
Thanks, Emily. Thanks, Tim. Take care.
Absolutely. Cheers.
Bye.
Oh, thank you so much, Claire. Claire did this interview when she was 2 days out of leaving from her position as the director. She didn't have to do this. She did because she's lovely.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I just think it's funny that we got to talk to Claire, Irish Claire, number one, who said goodbye to us and as our introduction to the city, and just the joy of an Irish goodbye. And then number two, being able to come back next week and talk to another Claire and fill in some of those gaps, because as we know, those handoffs are often kind of like a tennis match where you're kind of bouncing it back and forth. So she did a great job on her way out being like, hey, here we go.
Yeah, it's Claire squared, and I love it. I'm here for that. You know, and the other thing that I'm here for is, like, you know, it's very clear that the Claire's team, like, they've put a lot of care into making downtown feel active most days, not just like a few big weekends, not just when Taylor Swift rolls around, right? And, you know, they're in the process of using consistency to build trust, and trust builds vibrancy, right? Mm-hmm. And so taking that to be public space, as we say, is not fixing it, but as an invitation. And you can see how they're using events to reteach people how to be downtown again, right?
Especially
they don't have
COVID.
All the answers. They haven't fixed all of the problems, but, like, especially after COVID, that kind of cultural re-invitation is really essential. And I think that, you know, a lot of cities that we speak to have not made that necessary process of re-inviting people, rather than just presuming that everything goes back to normal and they just go back to doing their stuff as normal. Like, there really needs to be a concerted effort to re-invite people into that space.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to that removing revitalization as a word and just using invitation, right? And inviting intentionally with the language they even use as a team, that everything is that invitation rather than something that needs to be revitalized. I'm going to pause. Em, can you pause the recording?
Yeah.
Also, because I heard that door closed. And I think out of all of that, the thing that I loved most was that kind of UX or user experience style thinking, like testing, like sidewalk decals for wayfinding, measuring perceptions of safety and belonging. I think that goes back to that invitation piece. They're inviting people into belonging more than anything else in these spaces. But that's really where like the design thinking piece that I love that comes out of like the tech space meets placemaking in a very beautiful way. And in a way that is, like they have a formal process to it, but it's also incredibly flexible and allows them to have kind of this experimentation model that kind of treats every project a little bit like a startup. Like if they throw the pop-ups up there, the food trucks, is how does that land with the city? And, you know, as those kind of mini events that you were mentioning throughout the year rather than that big kickoff. And it's the way that they did that through that user-centered design that I think is really fascinating. But I have to ask him, because this is your space and we have a consistent conversation about events being this vibrancy strategy, and what it means for placemaking as a conversation, really running that risk of anchoring something to that spectacle, for lack of better words, without having it be a permanent thing that people can go to every day. Talk to us about your thoughts around this events placemaking piece, because it's
I think that, you know, what really kind of comes clear through as we spoke to Claire was that Vancouverites as a people seem to like new and they seem to like Instagrammable moments. And so it is really easy to fall into a trap of events make things new because they're temporary. We can tweak events and therefore that allows us to have spectacle. But as you say, if you don't anchor spectacle with something more permanent, then you run your team ragged, right? Like events cannot be the only vibrancy strategy. And that the interesting thing is that we have had this second conversation with our second Claire Leonard. And so we know that there are different ways that they are filling in the gaps around events. But if I just took this single conversation with Claire, I would come away thinking that the only thing that Vancouver focuses on is events and like, and maybe they're thinking of doing like a public art strategy, but like it's the heavy focus on the Granville block party still makes that vibrancy really episodic. It's that up and down of the roller coaster that, yes, consistency is key, but if people are only in there when events run, then that's still a problem, you know?
So then what's your message to cities who their event, I mean, their placemaking is this event focused strategy?
Yeah, it's easy to fall into that. As I say, it's easy to fall into that pattern of events mean vibrancy, events mean new and social media interest, but you've got to look at short-term, medium-term, long-term, right? You need all three of those to make a city vibrant, and events are not necessarily all there is to placemaking. They are the first pillar of placemaking, but they are not the complete package. And so you need to properly generate those third spaces where people will hang out automatically without the event to activate them. But then you also need something for people to do outside of events in a guided way. Right? But that's like locals and tourists, because you cannot always trust that tourism is going to be there because COVID might happen, because a administration of a very large company puts a bunch of tariffs in place and people don't want to travel. Not naming any names here, but it means that a whole bunch of domestic tourism ends up happening. It means that a whole bunch of staycations end up happening. And so the things that fill your events need to be there as well. Spaces, events, and then the connective tissue between those events to smooth out those up and down pieces. And so I would say to people who have a team that only focuses on events to potentially take a step back and be like, what are your tentpole public spaces?
I'm gonna pause you and I'm gonna ask you to say, I'm gonna ask a team because you had a bunch of notifications go off in the background. So can you just say what I'd say to a team and start again from there?
Okay. Let me just put that through. So what I would say to a team that is in that event space, right, is to take a step back and to look at, do I have enough of those third spaces? If I don't, how do I put those in place? And what can I take from the events that I am already doing that could exist beyond that event, right? Because you don't necessarily need to make a whole new thing to be in between events. You can leverage the events that you are already doing to leave things in place after that event comes out. And so that's what I would say. Take that step back, look at how can you leverage the events that you have to do fillers, and then how can you maybe increase the public spaces and the places that people want to linger, because you need those 310 poles for a truly vibrant city that appeals to locals and tourists alike.
Yeah, I think that leads me to kind of my follow-up reflection and kind of one of my own as well, as I hear your critique on that. I think what I'm really hearing is something that is obvious to maybe us, because we do this every day as a part of Story City, and it's that connective tissue piece, those gaps, the gap filling that you were just mentioning. Like when the music stops, who's still downtown, right? And I think that's the question that we ask as we start saying, hey, you know, places are great. Events are great. We're challenging people at Story City to take that next step of building those connective tissues. And we know that some cities only have their events, so they're not ready to build those connective tissues yet, right? They're not ready to work with us in that regard.
Agreed. And I think you're right. You're right. It's if you do not own the narrative between events, someone else will take that narrative over.
Right.
Right. 100%. Like if you do not own it, then someone else will come in to fill that gap. And that might be issues within the city. That might be, you know, systemic issues of all sorts of things, of homelessness, of all of, you know, of safety, of all of those kind of things, and media's reporting of crime. And that's the narrative that will take over if you do not take control of the narrative yourself between events.
And I think that's something that's super cool that the city of Vancouver is doing, that we'll hear a little bit more about next week, is how they're taking control of that narrative. But I think that one of the things that's really cool that Claire spoke about this week was really how one of the ways that they kind of touch I think of it like the string that the Fates are tying, like from Hercules, right? Like before they cut it, like one of those strings that is being grabbed is in that 90 block space is connecting commerce and like cultural belonging, right? Like they are doing what they can to, like, basically they have all of those businesses, they have all of that art that's already in the city, and I think that focusing on that re-inviting rather than that revitalization, right, they're not fixing the city, there's nothing that needs to be done to quote unquote fix the city following this conversation, but that idea of calling back to that, you know, they're inviting not just the residents of downtown Vancouver, they're inviting the business owners of downtown Vancouver, they're inviting the event organizers of downtown Vancouver, the nonprofits into their space as a part of that continuity building. Now I have some comments on how they're doing that, but I think that at the end of the day, they are starting to weave some of those threads in this conversation. And we know that for next week's conversation, they weave more into, it looks more like a tapestry, but for cities that only have that thread, it's kind of a challenge to say, how do we get this bid to talk to the city, to talk to the community?
How do you get them to build those kind of public-private partnerships to weave that thread, as you say? But also, you know, as part of taking that step back from events, you get that bigger view of what is the long-term community infrastructure to mitigate that risk, right?
And so, I think one of my questions,
other people don't fill in that cultural continuity. And I think that Claire number two, 2.0, upgraded Claire. No, that's not it. They were the Claires together, the Claire power combined. That's right. I think does a good job of filling in those gaps. So I don't want to, you know, this episode surfaces up some really great things that the city of Vancouver is doing, and that cities that do have these wonderful tentpole events are doing now. But it also shows what those potential gaps are, and it really leads us into the beautiful conversation you will hear with Claire Leonard that really fills in some of those gaps that we have seen in this first episode and the questions that came out of this first conversation.
Yeah, one of the questions I'm interested in seeing a little bit more of is really just the fact that this is a downtown BIA. This isn't the city doing all of this work, right? And so, like, the ability to balance, like, where did the roles and responsibilities start and end when you have a business improvement district or association that is tasked in its title with making sure that the businesses within its district are served and have a consistent flow of patrons, right? Near like through them and continually grow those businesses. Whereas the city is chartered for the people, right? And everybody who lives there,
yeah.
They, like, corporate people and individuals and organizations.
And it's interesting that the public arts strategy is a result for central downtown Vancouver resides in the BIA when you look at it in that delineated way.
With that lens. And I think that, like, kind of digging in a little bit more, it's the idea that, like, that therefore means that if we want our budget for next year, the businesses have to be happy. At the end of the day, everybody's voice matters, but the voice that is going to hold or carry the most weight is going to be those businesses that give revenue to the organization that is funding all of this.
Yeah. And I flip-flop about whether or not, like, public art should live within city versus within a BIA, but I think that something that has become a reoccurring thread in this season in particular is that because it resides within the BIA, it is an acknowledgement of the economic value of public art in attraction of visitation and then the building of economics and economic development in downtown, which I think is an important step for any city to make.
Yeah, and I think that one of the reasons we didn't hear Claire talk about that in this episode is that downtown Vancouver is full of art, right? They've already done the work to beautify this space, and so they don't have a beautification campaign. They have a let's activate the people campaign, but again, that art was paid for, and has the perspective of drawing business, and so, like, I don't know, where should it sit in? I think that that's a great question for everybody here to leave in wherever you can leave your comments, but, like, where should the funding for art belong in this space, and who should be empowering it? My thought would be everybody. Art is for everybody. It is cultural. It bonds us in a way that language limits, but I think that at the tail end of it, someone's got to pay for it and someone's got to pay to maintain it.
So next week, friends, we are going to be staying in Vancouver. This time, as we said, with Claire Leonard, who is stepping into Claire Warner's role with dignity and grace. And so together we all ask, how do you build a framework beyond events that sustains joy and safety and connection? And this is going to be part two of our downtown van story. Tune in for the next episode. Until
see
then.
See you next week.
Bye.
The Vibrant Spaces podcast is produced by Story City. You can find our entire archive on any podcasting app and on about.storycity.app, where we publish transcripts and show notes. This episode was produced by Tim Souza, and our staff includes Justin Kahn, Brett Ludwig, and Victoria Onitska. Our theme song is Happy Indie by Alex Guz,
our co-hosts are Tim Souza and me, Emily Craven. As always, thank you for listening. We hope you have a glorious adventure this week.